Welcome back to another episode of Coffee and Co-Sleeping. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Adriana. And I'm incredibly excited today to welcome our guest, someone that's near and dear to my heart, Selma Bachevats of Balkan Mama Therapy. Welcome this morning, Selma.
Thank you so much for having me on, Amanda and Adriana. It means a lot.
Selma, coming across your Instagram page, someone had shared something that you posted and it resonated with me so much. Before I even saw your Instagram handle, I clicked on the post and I was like, oh my God, this is another Bosnian woman and a Bosnian mother. So I was so excited to come across your page. I felt just immediately seen. Can you tell us about how Balkan Mama Therapy started or what was the inspiration behind it?
For sure. In 2013, I started my own private practice. I had gotten licensed as a licensed clinician here in the state of Florida. And as soon as I became a business owner and my name started being listed in the directories for mental health clinicians, I had started getting calls from Bosnian, Serbian, Croatian women wanting services with me. Well, I was really nervous to see adults at the time because I was trained in early childhood mental health. I helped mothers and children who were affected by trauma overcome that trauma and ensure that their relationship remained a safe and secure relationship. The early childhood mental health aspect wasn't something that really prepared me to work with adults. And I also was nervous, I'm sure Adriana can relate to this, working with Balkan people, Bosnian people, sometimes it can feel really overpowering. And I did not want to do things that I wasn't prepared for. And I was also nervous about working with Bosnian Balkan people in general. There's always this really big fear that, you know, you're not doing enough and you're not good enough for it. So fast forward to 2019, I had moved from Jacksonville, Florida to Tampa Bay, where I am at right now. My father, who has since passed from COVID, saw my interaction with my son and the different choices I was making. He was the one who would always make statements like, oh, navičeš ga na ruke, you're going to get him used to your hands. I would start these conversations with him and say, Dad, he's little, he needs me right now. He is not going to get used to my hands. He eventually is going to want to run around and walk around. He will not want anything to do with me. So we would have these conversations and he would look at me and say, like, you need to get this message in front of Bosnian parents, in front of Balkan parents, because many of us grew up with the idea that holding your baby would spoil them. And I would just shrug this off and say, oh, gosh, Dad, what Bosnian is going to listen to me? There's too many other people who are much smarter than me sharing this message. In 2020, when he got sick with COVID, he passed 4 months thereafter. When he passed, I wanted something to continue to bring meaning to my relationship with him. And I remember those words. He would constantly encourage me to tell our people about mental health and start including it in the conversation with Balkan people. I remember the day specifically. It was February 2021. I went on my Instagram and I changed my handle from, I think I was the baby and toddler therapist, to Balkan Mama Therapy. And I held my breath. Like, I thought I was going to pass out. To my surprise, so many people resonated with the things I was posting and the things I was sharing. And it slowly bloomed into a little community. And then this little community became a community of several thousand people, including, you know, non-mothers or soon-to-be mothers and fathers. Just an amazing experience overall.
This may be a new record for me. I'm 5 minutes in and I'm already starting to tear up over here. You speaking about your dad is just so beautiful. I'm so sorry for your loss. But when we talk a lot about our parents and the way they did things, the fact that he was so open and was like, you need to get this information out there. You know, I wanted to ask you why conscious parenting is so important to you and why getting this message across is so vital. And you really already answered that. I know you're doing a lot of the work really, you know, for your dad and for your son. And that's just really so beautiful. I'm throwing a curveball at you. We said before we started talking, there was going to be a lot that comes up that we don't have on our roadmap. And I already have something. You know, I'm from the US. When your dad was saying you need to get this message out to our people and to Bosnian parents specifically, why is that so important?
I think for him, what he meant by this was neuroscience behind it. I call it brain science. I would sit with him and I would explain to him, Dad, this is how my son's brain was responding to things. And I was talking about the brainstem and the limbic system and the cortex. My father would just sit there and be like, they have science to show this now? And be like, yeah, Dad, they do. And, you know, he would constantly say things like, if we had this information back when you guys were younger, we would have applied the same. And the reason this really meant a lot to him, I think, is because he noticed from his own experience and just seeing other parents within our community, the spanking that still happens, the belittling of our children. Children are seen, but they're not heard. I think for the Balkan culture in general, we have a very strong intergenerational trauma. The Balkans are very much known in the literature, academia, and just in the world in general for being a very unstable place because a lot of wars erupt and we're known to not like each other, etc. And as soon as I started diving more into this work, I really shifted my practice from working with children in the foster care and adoptive setting to Balkan families. And once I started shifting into that, I started obtaining more training in what it meant to have intergenerational trauma and learning from amazing Native American therapists and Native American trainers, Black therapists, Turkish therapists, expanding my base knowledge away from what Western psychology was teaching us to more of what collective psychology wants to know. And the more neuroscience dives into understanding what's best for a person from cradle to death, right, is connection, the key to having a really successful, and I don't mean like monetary success, I mean healthy connections and relationships with people, lies in having collective connection with people in your environment. And I feel that the United States and many Western societies have really stepped away from this. And there's this really big, deep, ultra-independent need to be, you know, self-sufficient, which is wonderful, but we can't do this alone. We're not meant to do this alone. And I think that's evident in just how much parents struggle all over the world right now, but primarily with my experience here in the United States, how much we struggle with parenting. It's lonely, it's exhausting, and it leads to things like sleep training and letting the kids cry it out, even though we know that science shows that these things can be really harmful.
As you were explaining, you know, your father really appreciating the science behind all of this, you and I know Balkan parents are extremely headstrong and very passionate. I think absolutely for my mother as well and for my grandparents, you know, being able to back some of my parenting choices, which I do sometimes feel like I need to validate or explain, having those facts and having science back some of my decisions has been the difference in them accepting it. I'm so proud of our heritage, and we could go on to speak about some of the wonderful things. Like you just mentioned, you know, co-sleeping in our culture is very common. I mean, no one's heard of sleep training. Even now, I was in Saudi Arabia over the summer with my son last year. He was very young, and sleep training was just not something that was a part of any of our conversations that I had with other parents. And breastfeeding past the year of one, another thing that was really not frowned upon or looked down upon or strange. You're saying you also had that same experience with your father, and that once you were able to provide him with the science, he was more accepting of those choices.
And encouraging, not just accepting, but encouraging to share this information. At the time, my brother also had little babies, and a lot of our extended circle was growing their family. So I think in his mind, it was just logic and it made a lot of sense. And he would actually bring in a lot of things that he remembered his grandmother doing. And he would be comparing what research would say with things like, in Bosnia, we say, stari ljudi dosta znaju. Older generations know a lot. He would always compare and say, my grandmother didn't have the science behind it, but it sounds like naturally she knew what to do because she would be somebody who wouldn't let children cry it out and would encourage co-sleeping, would relieve the mother from, you know, having to do anything around the house so she could spend her time with her children. My grandmother had 13 births, 9 living children. That is incredible to me, to have that many births and to go through the pain of losing several of your children and to parent 9 of them is fascinating.
That is unheard of here right now.
I know we touched on it a bit in the beginning. You mentioned the word intergenerational trauma, and we hear so much of that. I see it a lot on social media and cycle breaking, but can you break down a little bit what that means? I realize not everyone's really familiar with those terms, and I know it's something we really want to dive into. There's a lot of cycles that my parents did that I'm trying not to repeat. So I, you know, am a acclaimed cycle breaker, but I guess why?
Yeah. So intergenerational trauma is a term that came out about 100 years ago. Researchers and scientists were looking at if a grandparent behaved a certain way, the parent behaves a certain way, it will also affect a child. So environmentally, we thought that trauma could be passed down through our parenting experience. Since the Holocaust and the atrocities and the genocide and the massive killing of the Jewish population during the time, there have been many researchers in New York and Israel and Germany who are studying the effects of the Holocaust trauma on survivors. Since then, they have studied the effects of those traumas on the actual survivor, but also their offspring. And what science is showing is that trauma can be passed down through generations or inside of our DNA. It can be passed down through culture, and it can be passed down through environment, primarily parenting. What they're also noticing is that resilience or survival, and I guess in social media terms, many people term this wisdom, also passes down through the same effects, right? DNA and culture and parenting. So cycle breaking essentially means if you become aware that there is a trauma that produced an unhealthy coping mechanism, when you become aware of this unhealthy coping mechanism, you become a cycle breaker by changing that through your behavior or the way you think about it. To give an example, many people who've experienced trauma will have a very short fuse or short ability to process any stressful situation. Their body, their nervous system is immediately going to go into some type of mode, whether it's flight, fight, freeze, fawn. When that danger is no longer around, this trauma response doesn't really serve a purpose. So if a person experienced a form of trauma, let's say in the Holocaust, and now their grandchild is experiencing a stressful situation, their ability to experience the stressful situation is going to essentially have like a shorter fuse. If they did not receive appropriate parenting in a safe environment and had to struggle a lot themselves, then this shorter fuse is even going to become even shorter because of their ancestral experience. And they might respond to the stressor through a coping mechanism. That may be anxiety, that may be dismissiveness, that may be dissociation, etc. There are some studies to indicate that people can inherit actual memories from their ancestors. There's a beautiful woman, and I do not recall her name right now, but I can email that to you all so that you maybe can add her into the notes of your episode. She has written books, and she's actually from Hungary. She's a descendant from a survivor of the Holocaust. The reason she started studying how memories get passed down from generation to generation is because she experienced memories her grandmother experienced during the Holocaust. She would have visual memories of this. There are researchers and scientists out there indicating that this is also a possibility to have visual memories of your ancestors passed down, which is amazing to me. You get me to talk about intergenerational trauma, I can talk to you about it for days.
So I haven't spoken a lot about my background and my history so far on our platform, and I've been waiting for an opportunity to do so. I've noticed certain things come up through my parenting. I've had to really dig deep and go back really far to sort of identify where some of these mechanisms come from. I remember war starting in Sarajevo. I was at my grandparents' home. Parents and brother and sister were in another city. I do remember having to be extremely still and low to the ground, not go near any windows. I remember how my grandmother dealt with that. And I remember how my grandfather dealt with that, and both very differently. My father had to kind of sneak through to come get me and take me out. And that was like the car ride of a lifetime. Just Are we or are we not going to safely pass through the border? And I can't even imagine what that was like for my mother, you know, waiting to find out if her husband and daughter would safely make it out of her home country. Mm-hmm. I've seen this come up a lot for me throughout my life, is that freeze response. You know, when you go into a place of discomfort or anxiety or a situation that brings a lot up for you, I freeze. Another thing that I've noticed is I never really know how I'm feeling. Like, even if someone says to me at the grocery store, "How are you doing?" I more often than not will say, "I don't know. know. And that's just like my honest response. It takes me a while to identify how I'm feeling. And that bothered me as I came into adulthood. I really had to go back far to learn where that came from and where that started. And as you just mentioned, that can go, it does go back so much further than just our own experiences. You know, we can look to our parents, our grandparents. It's been so healing. And at times, honestly, tumultuous. It's a lot to learn about your history and to learn about where these mechanisms come from. And even just in the context of our culture, where these things come from and how they helped us with survival. It's heavy, but it's so important. And it's given me so many tools to be able to work on me. I think education is just so important. And that's why it was just so extremely validating, extremely comforting. And I can't even tell you, I can't give you a word for how I felt when I came across your page because I just felt so seen.
That means so much, Adriana. Thank you for sharing all of that. I relate to literally everything that you just said. And I want to point out to the beautiful strength that is present in your story. I know quite a lot we focus on the trauma, which is, it's a terrible thing. It's a scary thing. I call it like a virus that's infesting our culture. But there's a beautiful strength in all of this because many of our ancestors had to survive so many things in order for us, for you and I, to sit at this table and be able to discuss cycle breaking and trauma and how we don't want this to continue being a thing for our children and how to prepare them for, you know, difficult and scary situations. I think there's a big privilege in that. When we talk about nervous systems, you have your own individual nervous system that helps you respond to everything that's going on for you, but you also have an ancestral nervous system. Your nerves, your DNA knows how to respond to certain things because of them. They've equipped you with this. And I think that's so powerful. You never walk into a room by yourself. You always have the power of all of those who came before you inside of you, literally, in your DNA, and how then it goes into the rest of your body is incredible.
I just wanted to add, this is actually the first time I've heard that story told through you, Adriana. My husband had the opportunity 2 years ago to go to Bosnia with you and your family, and hearing him come back and the stories that he shared with me and your family, showing him, you know, where you grew up and, you know, being able to hear that, it's overwhelming to hear that young Adriana had to go through that. So Selma, did you leave at the same time then?
I left toward the end of the war. I left in November of 1994. I ended up being part of the Sarajevo siege for almost the full time that it went on. There's a lot of sadness and a lot of fear inside of our stories. But again, there's a lot of courage and strength and bravery, which I think when you go through your healing, and there's no end destination. Like when I talk about when you go through your healing, I am still on my healing journey. Like we'll never reach this this light, right, that you're supposed to reach. I feel like every time you uncover something, there's a deeper thing. And it's this enlightenment where you go in and you just learn and relearn and add to this wisdom that you then pass on to your child. When we talk about cycle breaking, I want to make one point clear. I, as a parent, even though I am in this practice, even though I dive into this topic really deeply, I will never be able to break all the cycles on my own for my children. My children are going to reach a different enlightenment. They're going to be on a different level and see the world through eyes that are going to teach me a lot of things when they get older. Through that experience, they will also be breaking cycles. But I hope that they are not, because of my work right now, there are not going to be cycles of not having a parent who isn't aware of the parent-child connection. And I feel in the Balkan culture, in the Bosnian culture, quite often, again, children are seen but not heard. And I want to give my children a platform to know that no matter what, mom and dad are there to support them and appreciate who they are and give them the ability to develop that authenticity. We talk about attachment a lot, but we don't talk about authenticity enough. And authenticity is what many of us as adults are seeking because we didn't have that ability to learn in our childhood. Many of us were in survival mode.
After we left and came here, at the very beginning of the war. It was about being seen and not heard, to not disturb the very fragile state that my home was in. You know, then you have parents who are dealing with trauma of their own in a different way. You know, they're older. This was their home country for their entire lives, and trying to get other family members over safely while raising children. It's things that, you know, I can't quite even imagine the difficulties of. And so as a child internalizing that, it was, now I need to be somewhat invisible just to not rock this boat, which is already in really tumultuous weather. We're on rocky grounds right now. And the best that I can be is quiet, you know, is to not shake this any more than it is already shaking. That was my feeling for a really long time. And Selma, I know you and I very briefly discussed this, but as tough as it can be to navigate some of these things, because it brings up a lot, it's also been extremely healing to give my son something that I know I really needed. It's been so healing, and it fills my heart in a way that I didn't know it would. These were things that you don't really think about, you know, when you're pregnant or when you're imagining that perfect family. I definitely wasn't thinking like, I wonder how my intergenerational trauma is going to come up for me. You know, like, it just, those aren't the things that we think about when we're pregnant. At least I wasn't. It's a little more romantic, you know, in those early stages. And then when your baby comes, and as they grow, and as you notice yourself as a parent, a lot of these things come up a lot of the time unexpectedly. And some of the things that I thought I had worked on, I realize I need a lot more work on. That's why I love what you said about the journey never quite being over. I don't think it ever can be. I think that there's just so much in this one lifetime that we have to uncover and to learn about ourselves and our histories, that it's hard to imagine that ending. It's a lifelong process.
Every season is going to bring a different learning experience for you. I love what you just said about, I wanted to give my son something I never received. I always ask myself a question when I hear someone say that, or I say this myself. I wonder what my child's life is going to look like, because they have someone in their corner they know they can always rely on. But not just that, they had the privilege of really exploring life on their terms. And that's a privilege that, you know, not many people have.
Everything about the healing journey that you said, Selma, is really so validating for me. I've mentioned in previous episodes, I actually don't speak to either one of my parents. I have no contact, no relationship with them. And it's like, as soon as I feel like I'm at a point where it's like, oh, I've worked through this, like I'm at peace, I feel ease and comfort in this situation, something comes up, whether it be from them or even just within my own life, that kind of causes some mixed emotions. It's never done. It's always a journey. And I actually had an opposite experience than you, Adriana. While I was pregnant, I did think, how is my trauma going to come up? Because I knew that I had no contact with my mom, which is where a lot of my trauma stems from, you know, the sense of abandonment and not having parents, you know, not physically, but emotionally and mentally. So I was thinking to myself, how am I now going to raise this child when I don't know how to do that? You know, I haven't had an example of really how to do this. You know, I had my grandparents, but it's like, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, how am I going to become a mom without having one? And I know there's a lot of people that have to navigate that on their own. And I was, you know, fortunate for the other people that I have in my life, being my grandparents and my in-laws and my husband, but it's a journey, and it's never, you're never as healed as you think you are, something I've been learning recently.
To just add something to what you said, Amanda, I want to give you a little bit of a reframe on what you said, that your trauma stems from the abandonment between you and your parents. I would reframe and say that the trauma stems from way before then. I wonder what happened to your parents in order for them to behave in a way that would push away from something that they naturally, their brain and bodies naturally were programmed to do by biology, right? Something happens to our parents in order for them to push away. The hardest part I find in the healing process, there's a disenfranchised grief about grieving parents who are alive, but you know that you will not get that connection or the needs that you need from them filled ever. And there's a big pain in that. There's a big sadness in that. When we are on our healing journey, it is so important to be compassionate toward ourselves, the same way we would be compassionate toward our children when they come to us and say, I am struggling with this, help me, to show that same compassion toward ourselves, because there's a lot of shame and a lot of blame inside our own healing. And those cycles can be really hard to break. So I applaud you for saying this out loud and knowing that you are working actively on this, and good for you. But I want to reiterate that this trauma does not originate with you. It's not something about you. It is something that happened long ago that unleashed its roots way before you or your parents came along. Something happened.
Yeah. And I know for my parents in particular, a lot of that is mental health issues and substance abuse. But I think too, because, you know, I was raised by such a strong influence with my grandparents, it's like they couldn't have done anything. You know, I look at them, they were my saving grace. They came in and kind of swooped us away from it. So I always think like they couldn't have done anything to make my mom make these decisions and act this way. Mm-hmm. And that's just being naive. I mean, we know that. My mom and myself as well, we were raised very strict Irish Catholic. There's a lot that stems from that that I don't necessarily agree with. And you become an adult and you look back on things and you're like, that could have been handled differently, or I wouldn't really do it, you know, that way for my children.
If someone has maybe just even through listening to us today, recognize that they're experiencing effects of intergenerational trauma, or they're trying to cycle break. You know, Amanda and I have educated ourselves as much as we can through this platform by interviewing people like you and sitting down with people like you. And that education has been key in parts of our healing journeys. So if someone has coming to the place, you know, identifying this is something that I've experienced, you know, I'm hearing a lot about myself through this episode, what's a good starting place, or what advice might you offer as they just begin to do the work?
This is such an important question. And I think everyone in this work will agree with me here. Recognizing that there's nothing wrong about you. There's nothing to be fixed about you. And compassionately looking at this overwhelming awareness now that there, you know, have been traumas that were out of your control, or your parents' control, your grandparents' control, and other people in your lineage, where things just happened. When trauma is left unhealed, it finds its way to repeat itself. It finds its way to remain inside of our bodies, inside of our culture, inside of our relationships and experience. So when you first become aware of this, first recognize there's nothing wrong with you. Nothing to be fixed about you. It's about taking on this journey through compassion. And I call them gentle eyes. Put some gentle eyes on top of yourself and look at yourself through the same gentleness that you would look at your children through. Because this sometimes can be really painful to go, and it may unlock a lot of shame. And if the shame shows up, show a lot of compassion toward yourself.
I think that's so important, because we all know we're our own biggest critic. We're so gentle and kind to our children, but then sometimes the way we speak to ourselves is a complete 180 of that. And I know the biggest thing for me has really been setting really firm boundaries. And I feel like when it comes to family, it can be really touchy and difficult to navigate. So I wanted to ask you, what's your advice on approaching this if we're looking to be both firm but respectful at the same time?
I can speak for what has worked for me. As I went through initial healing, I became more aware that my relationship with my mom was very codependent. If she was not having a good day, I would have found a reason not to have a good day. The whole household would not be having a good day. It really stung really deep when my therapist suggested that I might have a codependent relationship with my mother, who I idolized as a teen and as a young adult. I actually got really mad at my therapist and told her I wouldn't be back, because how dare she talk about my mother, who is such a hardworking, self-sacrificing individual, and all the things that she has provided for me. How could I ever consider not being present for my mother? And then as I became a therapist and I learned about all of these important things in attachment and relationships and attunement and just overall connection between nervous systems, I began to recognize that I needed to step away from this belief that I owed my mother something. I didn't owe anybody anything. I was literally brought into this world because my mother made a contract with herself that she wants a child. And when you bring a child into the world, you make the contract and say, I will do whatever I can to make sure that you grow up into an adult who is healthy and can function and be independent on their own and survive. Fast forward 20 some years, I became aware that I did not owe my parents anything. And culturally, that's very hard for our parents to understand. But I didn't need my parents to understand that. I needed to give myself permission to understand that. I needed to give myself permission to say, Selma, you don't owe your mother a therapy session. You don't owe your mother the feeling of guilt because it's not healthy. And if mom was healthy enough in this sense, emotional sense, she wouldn't be placing this upon you. So you have this awareness right now. If you want to have a healthy relationship with mom, you need to stop forcing yourself into positions just to people please mom and not disappoint her. Because the worst thing that is going to happen, if you say no to her, she might have a little bit of a tantrum, but you'll survive. And my mother's tantrums used to be yelling at me. They would be, you know, how dare you? Do you know who you're talking to? I am your mother, all the things I sacrifice. And she would say some very inappropriate things in that, you know, it would have been better if we didn't survive the war, if you're going to continue talking to me this way. So all of this emotional guilt tripping is what I would have to go through. And this is way before I became a parent. So I remember sitting down and listing all the things I would expect my mother to say. And I would literally sit there and give myself permission. If mom says, how dare you do this? Do you know who you're talking to? My response to that is going to be fear. I am fearful of my mother in that space. But if I am fearful, I am in control of my fear. I can regulate my fear. My fear does not control me. I am able to regulate it. So there was a good portion of my time with my mom when I would go talk to her, but I would have ice cubes with me all the time. And anytime the fear would come up for me, my nervous system was so automatic in wanting to respond to please her. I would either put this ice cube in my mouth and chew on it, or I would hold it in my hand until it became really cold in my hand and my fear no longer was the primary feeling, but it was more like, oh crap, the pain in my hand is stronger than the fear. And I would just breathe through it. And once I did this a couple of times, I realized my mom survived, I survived, everybody's fine. I remember there was a portion in this space where she then would turn and say, ugh, what's the point of talking to you anyway? You've got your American boundaries. You're going to practice your American boundaries. I remember reaching a point in my healing where I recognized that I did not need my mother's approval for anything because I am responsible for my own self. And I am the only one who can give that comfort to myself as an adult, right? If we were in a healthy parent-child dynamic, this would have looked very different. But unfortunately, because of all the traumas in her life, the environmental traumas we survived during the war and being refugees and resettled refugees, all of this played a factor in our relationship. So to put those boundaries in place takes a lot of self-reflection and actively reminding yourself that you are no longer that little child, that you are an adult who is not dependent on that person anymore, and that you can respectfully love them, but not agree with them always and do things that they require of you. They will survive. They have survived without your help way before you came along. They will survive again.
This is also very validating. I'm hearing you, and I really appreciate you for sharing so much of your personal story, because I think there's a lot of moms out there that can really relate to it. I feel like as humans, we really strive to people please. But I have kind of a personal question for both of you ladies. Why is the need for pleasing our parents, why is it so like held to a higher importance in the Bosnian culture? Why is that?
I relate so much to every single thing that you just said, Selma. I think in our culture, family loyalty is so important, and it really does take a village to raise a child. You know, you live at home, again, this is generalizing, but till you're married, it's just this very interconnected experience, which is a lot less common here. I think there's this push for independence. You turn 18, time to go, you know,
it's 100%. Yeah.
Very much not like that, even to this day in Bosnia. So as Selma was just speaking, and I absolutely want to hear her thoughts on your question as well, I think the part that I'm in the thick of right now, you know, Selma, you said it's about accepting myself, that I'm not responsible for my parents' feelings. I'm in the thick of that. I became a solo parent very unexpectedly right after giving birth to my son. So I'm actually living back at home with family. And while I'm extraordinarily grateful, it's very triggering. Mm-hmm. And I'm revisiting things that are hard to revisit. But it's this sense of, even if, you know, I hear it from Selma, even if I were to hear it from my own parent, you know, you're not responsible for my feelings. I don't believe that yet. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to learn about all of these things and to sort of see where you fit into the picture and to be like, okay, this makes sense. It's another thing to feel it inside. I'm at the point in my journey where all of these things are very clear and present, but I'm trying to fit the pieces of the puzzle together.
Yeah, I find that we are so, that was beautiful, Adriana. Thank you for sharing that. We process culturally, and I'm not speaking for just the Balkan culture. I think worldwide, like humans, process emotions intellectually. I remember having to learn to process my feelings through my body. I had no idea what the heck that meant. I was like, well, what do you mean? I know what feeling sad is, and I can tell you what feeling sad is. But then when my therapist asked, what does feeling sad feel like inside of your body? That took forever for me to explain and comprehend and figure out and have the courage to say out loud. Because for some reason, I can tell you about my sadness like a laundry list, but do not ask me about my sadness and what it feels like inside of my body, because I will embarrassingly fall wide open in front of you. And that vulnerability is not something that I knew how to be comfortable with. I went from being so closed off and not saying anything to anybody to then have like this total access to me. Like I would share my traumas with people all the time to educate them about, oh my gosh, you have to learn about this. You know, it became this open book. And I also recognized that that was a trauma response when you become so open. So there has to be a healthy dynamic of when do you show vulnerability? Who do you show vulnerability to? Add to what Adriana was saying, I would say that in the Balkan culture in general, but I will speak for the Bosnian culture, patriarchy is very much alive and well, which I think it is also in the United States, but I think we have a much more raw patriarchy in Bosnia still, where girls are raised to be nice. You're not raised to, you know, show your anger. You're not raised to tell people no. You're raised to be nice. And if you're not nice, then you're not feminine enough. You're not going to get married. You're not going to be able to be a pretty girl and all of these wonderful things. Boys are not expected to be parent pleasers. They're expected to take care of their parents financially. But emotionally, many boys are not expected to really care what happens in, you know, with their parents. As long as they're okay, their parents will be okay in terms of financial and environmental support. But girls have a much deeper, you know, they're the caretakers. They're going to become mothers. You caretake the feelings of your parents from a very young age. And if I could push this even further, I think that many of our parents had children in order to have someone to boss around, not because they wanted children. It's a cultural expectation to have children as soon as you get married, because you're not fulfilled as a woman unless you have children. And that's something that we are changing slowly. And as soon as you're married, you're expected to have a child and another child. And then, you know, how many are you going to have? And many of our mothers, I don't think, actively sat down and said, okay, I am going to learn about parenting. I am going to create a safe enough environment for my child and then think about having children at the point. I think it just happened as soon as they got married. That was culturally accepted and expected. I just wanted to add to what Adriana was saying and add the patriarchy into this for sure.
You know, in the US, you could get married and choose not to have kids for 7-10 years. And I think most parents would be like happy for that, you know, oh, travel and, you know, enjoy your 20s, you know, get your degrees, do that later. I didn't realize there was so much of that pressure. And especially as women growing up, to feel like you have to kind of do it all, you know, we have those pressures anyway as a woman, but then to have your parents, I mean, what if you didn't want to get married? What if you didn't want to do those things?
Yeah, and I think our grandmothers had it a lot harder, and our mothers broke a lot of cycles in that respect. My mother chose not to have children immediately. She went to school, she became an attorney, and then in her late 20s, she started having children. My father was in his 30s, and that was a big cycle break because her mother started having children at the age of 15. That gave me permission. Like, I never had the expectation of having to be married really early, but there was always the statement around me, you know, if you pass the age of 25, you're considered an old
25 old is so woman. Young. Oh my God, I look at 25 like a baby.
I know. It is wow. It's fascinating to me. And I did get married at 25, but I didn't have children until 33. I look at my daughter and my son now, and I'm just like, you know, I don't even care if you get married. Live your life the way that feels safe and good for you and safe in terms of emotions and connection. Take challenges and take risks and do things that are not culturally expected. I would love for you to do that. And we haven't even talked about, you know, the attunement behind all of this and how connecting to our children is so important. And I don't think many of our mothers had the privilege of connection with their mothers because of a lot of that intergenerational stuff. And then offering us the same with a war looming over their head was really challenging and hard. I was very angry at my mother for a very long time. And then I realized a lot of my anger was very patriarchy centered as well, because my mother was responsible for caretaking and caregiving and parenting, while my father was a fun parent, right? And that wasn't okay. Now I look at my mother through so much compassion. I see her literally as the little girl that she still is inside, who is so scared and hurt. And I just want to hold that little girl and say, hey, you know, it's going to be okay, but I can't until she allows that to come through. She does see the relationship I have with my children and constantly says things to me, you know, I wish I had this knowledge when I was parenting you guys when you were this little. I find that to be her way of saying, you know, if I had this, I would have done things differently.
Mm-hmm. And now that we know better, we're able to choose to do better for our children. And I just wanted to let you ladies both know how much I really appreciate this convo. I feel like I've gotten to know Adriana so much more just through this conversation and talking about our childhoods and things that we've been exposed to. And Selma, we found your account, gosh, months ago. And it was right when Adriana and I kicked off this season. She sent it to me and she's like, okay, this is my must-have guest. And just following you and going through your stuff, I've learned so much on your content. And I really appreciate and respect the work that you're doing.
Thank you. That really, really means a lot.
I think a lot of people from different cultures can relate to our culture. Mm-hmm. I know in some ways that interconnectedness, that family loyalty, there are similarities. While your community is meant to heal and help Balkan women and Balkan people and mothers, and it's done that for me so far, I know that it could reach so many others and be just as pertinent and relevant and healing as it is for us. That's the beauty of your platform, you know, learning about intergenerational trauma and learning about family cycles and cycle breaking in general, and how to have that compassion for yourself and for the person that your parents were and who they needed when they were little. This can really apply to everyone. I just wanted you to talk a little bit about the importance of support through early motherhood and why connecting with like-minded parents is so important, even other parents that are on their conscious parenting journey. Why is that so important when we first become parents?
The straightforward response to that is because we're not meant to do this alone. We need community. The opposite of trauma is not safety. The opposite of trauma is connection. And when we are on a healing journey, or we are healing our wounds, our ancestral wounds, to really benefit from healing and get all of its beautiful effects into our lives, that healing needs to take place inside of a safe and brave community. Community is so important because it allows that connection to soar through. When you find other mothers, other women, other fathers who are talking about the same importance of connection and parenting and conscious parenting and gentle parenting, but they also have a very similar background to, you know, healing their generational trauma and overcoming their own stuff, you all of a sudden don't feel alone anymore. And when you do not feel alone anymore, then trauma doesn't have a space anymore to cause shame. Trauma remains inside of our bodies because it's locked in there because of shame. no one really wants to carry this mountain of trauma around with them, right? But it remains inside of our bodies because of shame, because we feel alone and isolated in our experience, like something is bad and wrong about us. So in motherhood, this connection to other mothers is incredibly important, even if it is just to say, today is a terrible day and I am so proud of myself for not losing my mind 10 times. I lost my mind 3 times. And that's the reality of it. Conscious parenting, connection-based parenting, it's not about perfection. It's about being good enough. Sometimes I feel like when we follow these social media accounts that talk about connection and conscious parenting, it can feel really overwhelming. Like, oh my gosh, I'm messing my kid up even though I'm trying all of these things. And what I have found through my training in attachment theory is that good enough is really good enough. So most research suggests if 30% out of your 100%, if 30% of the time you are practicing consciously parenting your child will be okay. And I find that to be incredibly important to voice and say out loud. That repair is how you build connection and safety inside the parent-child relationship. When things are perfect, you're not preparing your child for the challenges they might have inside of their lives growing up. But when you teach them how to repair, when yesterday I had a really difficult parenting day because the grief over losing my father soared inside of me. I was really short with my attention span with my children. And they noticed, and my three-year-old came to me and said, oh, mommy doesn't want to play with me. Mommy is thinking about other things. That really hit me really deep. And I went down to his eye level and I said, Adam, I'm so sorry that mommy is not feeling well. I miss Dede, who is my father. We have a little corner inside of our room with like a little yellow heart representing my father. So he walked up to it and he gave it a kiss and he said, mommy, will that make you feel better? And I said, you know what? It does. And I'm so sorry that mommy was so sad today. I'm having a hard time, but I will try a little bit harder, okay? As soon as I said that to him, you could feel his little body just feel more connected to me and more attuned. Attunement is so important because it's this parallel ability. It's not about always making our child feel good. It's about allowing our child to see us in our states of emotion that may not be perceived as positive by society. So
I just have to pick up this mic over here that you just dropped because that was everything. I think even when this platform started, you know, I practice conscious, respectful parenting, but sometimes I can even get in my own head following these other pages in the community thinking, you know, I'm not doing it right. I'm not doing enough. And it's not about being perfect. It's not about the scripts and saying the right thing at the right time. Really, so much of it is in the repair, which I find myself doing, you know, often. Yeah. And I'll tell my daughter, I'm like, sorry, you know, I'm tired. We didn't sleep right. You know, I'll be honest with her. My daughter's 3 as well. So I'm able to really connect with her and communicate with her and she understands. But I think so many times we make so many generalizations about conscious parenting that like you're Mary Poppins all the time. And I'm like, that's just not true. I mean, this shit's hard. Mm-hmm. We have our hard moments. We break down. You know, I may be a respectful parent, but I'm also human. You know, I also have my own emotions and things. And I wanted to ask you, what has been the most challenging part of parenthood for you? And what have you found to be the most surprising?
I find that there's so many challenges. When I was pregnant with my son, I had this work-related baby shower and I got this card from a coworker and that said, you are going to raise the most perfect child with all the things that you know. That hit me like a ton of bricks at the time because I felt like the biggest fraud. Like, how am I going to raise a perfect child when I'm going through so much stuff of my own? It's going to affect them for sure. When I went through attachment theory parenting course, and this was more on a professional level because I wanted to provide this training to other parents, I learned about this 30% rule. And what really surprised me the most was the amount of anger that will show up out of the freaking blue when my child doesn't do something by the third time I ask them to do it. This anger wants to come out of me like I envision it like this, the ugliest storm coming out of me, like a tornado and wanting to like take my child for a spin inside of this tornado. Like, I want to just tell him how angry he makes me feel, and I want to hurt him with my anger. To me, because I grew up with a very reactive mother, this is a cycle-breaking moment for me, because even though my anger does come out at times and I raise my voice, it is never to the point of my voice getting scary toward my child, because I feel the adrenaline rush inside of my body. I've had to work really hard on this. When I feel the adrenaline rush, I know that this is a trigger for me and that this has nothing to do with my child. That some unhealed part of me now wants to take it out on my child. I'm looking for him to save me from my feeling, when it needs to be the other way around, for me to teach him how to process this feeling and what's going on for him. So when I feel this adrenaline rush coming on, I catch myself and I stop. I literally stop everything I am doing. I take a seat and I take a deep breath. It's a 2-second ordeal. And I am so proud of that for myself, because I can see how certain things would have been so difficult for my mother to go through. And I'm so proud of my ability to break that for myself, but also for my mother and for my children, because she is able to now, which is also a little bit of a mind twist. She comes to me and says, just don't yell at him over this. He's a baby. He's 3. And I'm like, Mom, really? Where was this person 30 some years ago? So I am so stinking proud of that ability. And I remember I journaled about this when I got the email from you all about the questions you might be asking me. And yeah, that struck me really hard. And I was just so proud of that. And I had a discussion with my husband. And I said, you know, when I yell at him, and my husband's like, you yell at our children? I've never seen you yell at our children. I was a complete ball of emotions at that point. Like, oh my gosh, you don't see me yelling at our children? He goes, I've seen you be firm with them, but I've never seen you yell at them. And to me, that was huge.
Something that I had to work around shame with has been how quickly I can go to anger. It's so hard for me to go into a place of sadness. It's incredibly easy for me to go to a place of anger. And I've had to really work around understanding that. And to just add on to what Selma just said, that's something I've really had to work around with my son now that he's 18 months old and, you know, everything's exciting. Everything, he wants to get into everything. Everything's new. He can explore. He's understanding things more. He's making these connections, cause and effect. And, you know, that can look really challenging with an 18-month-old. That interest in the cause and effect, that can look like, you know, throwing things over the banister or liking to see things break and being really excited by it. And one thing that's helped has been just under my own breath while he's busy breaking things before I intervene, has been to just under my own breath to myself say, Adriana, you can feel yourself getting angry. Actually saying it out loud, it calms me down. I don't know if it's the pause or if it's the being able to identify that feeling. I know earlier I mentioned that's so hard for me to do or to own. So if I can just say, like, take a deep breath, sometimes I actually need to say it out loud to then follow it. And it's such a good feeling, to Selma's point. You just feel like it's such a win, you know, you feel so much pride to be able to do that for your child.
And I'd agree with that for myself. I feel like I don't ever really feel sadness a whole lot. I feel like if I'm sad about something completely even unrelated to my daughter or anything, then I get angry. That's kind of the go-to. And I feel like a lot of moms will probably agree with that. It's kind of like a go-to emotion. We just become so reactive, which is, again, something that I learned from my childhood. So just trying to break that. I'm going to try the speaking out loud thing to myself. I talk to myself most of the day. So maybe if I just tell myself, chill out a little bit, I'll actually listen to it.
It's wonderful. And I love that you're able to label that for yourself, Adriana. You know, I internalize a lot of things. So listening to my body and feeling my adrenaline rush, it comes right behind my ears, like my heartbeat comes into my ears. And as soon as I feel that, I know that's my sign. Okay, whatever is going on, stop it. It really, really helps.
Everything's just so connected. Everything we're talking about, I could refer to other points in our conversation. I think as women, we've often been taught to ignore that feeling of like that adrenaline rush, that pressing to address something within us. I know for myself, there's been this built-in mechanism to suppress that. So addressing it in the beginning was definitely, was new. But Selma, thank you so much for this conversation. It's been It's been so wonderful. I'm really excited for other parents to hear this. But we cannot leave the conversation without asking you an incredibly important question, especially as a Bosnian woman. I'm hoping for a good answer here. What is your go-to coffee order, or how do you prepare coffee in the morning?
I drink Bosnian coffee in the morning.
Love it.
That's what you're told. It's Zlatna Jezva. I cannot do any other coffee. It's a coffee brand from Bosnia, and every single morning is two cups of very strong Bosnian coffee. If I was to run out to Starbucks, I am not a big complicated drink drinker. I love just getting a straight cappuccino from there. When I was breastfeeding, I read somewhere that like the pink drink helps you produce. So I was obsessed with the pink drink.
I've never actually tried that. I've heard a lot about it.
It's delicious. It's delicious. But I can't say whether or not it helped with the breast milk production, but it sure tasted good.
When my husband went to Bosnia, he said his favorite part. He's like, yeah, it was beautiful. I learned so much about the culture, got to know Adriana. He's like, but the coffee. He came back with this whole, I don't even know how to explain it. It's like it's a little coffee pot and these little like mugs, this whole thing
that
I have out displayed. And he was like, okay, let me make it. And I was just going to throw it in like the Ninja coffee bar. And he's like, whoa. Whoa. And he's like watching this YouTube video. It's a whole process. I'm like, I need caffeine, but literally straight rocket fuel. My husband doesn't even drink coffee. So I'm like, were you just like wired 24/7 your trip? He's like, yeah, I was just like, not so much caffeine. I know we talked a lot about the community that you have on Instagram, but can you let our listeners know a little bit about where they can find you and everything that you have going on? I know you have a book coming out soon that I want you to mention as well.
Yeah. So if anyone is looking to diversify their bookshelf and include stories like mine and Adriana's into their child's bookshelf, I have written a book for kids 3 to about 7 years of age. And I tell the story of Bosnian refugees, especially with everything going on with Ukraine right now. It's very triggering for many of us from Bosnia and Eastern Europe. The topic of refugee and war is so important and necessary to have. 61 million people across the world are refugees, and you know someone. You're listening to Adriana's podcast, Amanda's podcast. We've had this experience. The book is called Adam and the Magic Fenyed, and Fenyed is a lantern, and it can be found on Instagram on a page called Mighty Balkan Kids. Or you can pre-order it at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Walmart and all of these wonderful other platforms. So Adam and the Magic Fenyed is the book, and my platform is Balkan Mama Therapy on Instagram.
I cannot wait. I will definitely be purchasing that book for my daughter. I'm so excited to check it out.
Yes, it was such a labor of love. I initially had this thought of writing this book several years ago when I was pregnant with my first baby, which unfortunately ended in a miscarriage, and then becoming pregnant again. I wrote it last year, and it was illustrated by another Bosnian refugee, and it was wonderful to collaborate with Neda on this. Just a beautiful experience.
I recently joined your Balkan Sisterhood community. And it's just what you offer there. First of all, I don't know how you have the time. There's just, you do so much. It's like, I'm so just like awestruck by everything it is that you're doing on top of being a mother.
Yeah.
The Balkan Sisterhood community, for all of our Balkan sisters that are listening, can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So the Balkan Sisterhood community is a space for Balkan women who are going through their healing journey, but are looking for a community of like-minded women where they can come in and heal together. The community offers master classes, it offers healing circles, it offers a book club. And we also have a community on Slack where we kind of support each other on there as well. I just absolutely love the community because it is filled with women from all over the Balkans living in the diaspora right now. Some women are refugees and some women are immigrants, but our stories are so much alike. And healing really happens inside community. It doesn't happen on its own. It happens inside of a community. So I really appreciate you for sharing this. So the Balkan Healing and Sisterhood community is also on Instagram, and you can find all of that information on my page.
And you're so right. It doesn't, I mean, we can't do this alone. I feel like we've said that quite a few times during this episode, and it's so true. You know, no healing really starts until we have the support of whether it be our friends or family. So Selma, thank you so much. It's been such an honor to have you on and for being so vulnerable and sharing your story with us, because it's important. And I'm just so happy that our listeners are able to hear it.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was wonderful.